Chapter 16. Halston, before he died, was destined to see atomic energy dominating every other source of power, but for some years, yet a vast network of difficulties in detail and application kept the new discovery from any effective invasion of ordinary life. The path from the laboratory to the workshop is sometimes a tortuous one. Electromagnetic radiations were known and demonstrated for 20 years before Mark and I made them practically available, and in the same way it was 20 years before induced radioactivity could be brought to practical utilization. The thing, of course, was discussed very much, more perhaps at the time of its discovery than during the interval of technical adaptation, but with very little realization of the huge economic revolution that impended. What chiefly impressed the journalists of 1933 was the production of gold from bismuth, and the realization, albeit upon unprofitable lines of the alchemists' dreams, there was a considerable amount of discussion and expectation in that more intelligent chapter of the educated publics of the various civilized countries which followed scientific development. But for the most part the world went about its business as the inhabitants of those Swiss villages which live under the perpetual threat of overhanging rocks and mountains go about their business just as though the possible was impossible, as though the inevitable was postponed forever because it was delayed. It was in 1953 that the first Holston-Roberts engine brought induced radioactivity into the sphere of industrial production, and its first general use was to replace the steam engine in electrical generating stations. Hard upon the appearance of this came the Dasdata engine, the invention of two among the brilliant galaxy of Bengali inventors. The modernization of Indian thought was producing at this time, which was used chiefly for automobiles, aeroplanes, waterplanes, and such like, mobile purposes. The American Kemp engine, differing widely in principle but equally practicable, and the Krupp Erlanger came hard upon the heels of this, and by the autumn of 1954 a gigantic replacement of industrial methods and machinery was in progress all about the habitable globe. Small wonder was this when the cost, even of these earliest and clumsiest of atomic engines, is compared with that of the power they superseded. Allowing for lubrication, the Dasdata engine, once it was started, cost a penny to run 37 miles, and added only 9.25 pounds to the weight of the carriage it drove. It made the heavy alcohol-driven automobile of the time ridiculous in appearance as well as preposterously costly. For many years the price of coal and every form of liquid fuel had been clambering to levels that made even the revival of the draft horse seem a practicable possibility, and now with the abrupt relaxation of this stringency, the change in appearance of the traffic upon the world's roads was instantaneous. In 3 years the frightful armored monsters that had hooted and smoked and thundered about the world for 4 awful decades were swept away to the dealers in old metal, and the highways thronged with light and clean and shimmering shapes of silvered steel. At the same time a new impetus was given to aviation by the relatively enormous power for weight of the atomic engine. It was at last possible to add Redmayne's ingenious helicopter ascent and descent engine to the vertical propeller that had hitherto been the sole driving force of the aeroplane without overweighting the machine, and men found themselves possessed of an instrument of flight that could hover, or ascend or descend vertically and gently as well as rush wildly through the air. The last dread of flying vanished. As the journalists of the time phrased it, this was the epoch of the leap into the air. The new atomic aeroplane became indeed a mania. Every one of means was frantic to possess a thing so controllable, so secure and so free from the dust and danger of the road, and in France alone in the year 1943 30,000 of these new aeroplanes were manufactured and licensed, and soared humming softly into the sky. And with an equal speed atomic engines of various types invaded industrialism. The railways paid enormous premiums for priority in the delivery of atomic traction engines. Atomic smelting was embarked upon so eagerly as to lead to a number of disastrous explosions due to inexperienced handling of the new power, and the revolutionary cheapening of both materials and electricity made the entire reconstruction of domestic buildings a matter merely dependent upon a reorganization of the methods of the builder and the house furnisher. Viewed from the side of the new power, and from the point of view of those who financed and manufactured the new engines and material it required, the age of the leap into the air was one of astonishing prosperity. Patent-holding companies were presently paying dividends of 500 or 600%, and enormous fortunes were made and fantastic wages earned by all who were concerned in the new developments. This prosperity was not a little enhanced by the fact that in both the Dastada and Holston Roberts engines one of the recoverable waste products was gold, the former disintegrated dust of bismuth, and the latter dust of lead, and that this new supply of gold led quite naturally to a rise in prices throughout the world. This spectacle of feverish enterprise was productivity. This crowding flight of happy and fortunate rich people, every great city was as if a crawling anthill had suddenly taken wing, was the bright side of the opening phase of the new epoch in human history. Beneath that brightness was a gathering darkness, a deepening dismay. If there was a vast development of production, there was also a huge destruction of values. These glaring factories working night and day, these glittering new vehicles swinging noiselessly along the roads, these flights of dragonflies that swooped and soared and circled in the air, were indeed no more than the brightnesses of lamps and fires that gleam out when the world sinks towards twilight and the night. Between these high lights accumulated disaster, social catastrophe. The coal mines were manifestly doomed to closure at no very distant date. The vast amount of capital invested in oil was becoming unsaleable. Millions of coal miners, steel workers upon the old lines, vast swarms of unskilled or underskilled laborers in innumerable occupations were being flung out of employment by the superior efficiency of the new machinery. The rapid fall in the cost of transit was destroying high land values at every center of population. The value of existing house property had become problematical. Gold was undergoing headlong depreciation. All the securities upon which the credit of the world rested were slipping and sliding, banks were tottering, the stock exchanges were scenes of feverish panic. This was the reverse of the spectacle. These were the black and monstrous under consequences of the leap into the air. There is a story of a demented London stockbroker running out into Threadneedle Street and tearing off his clothes as he ran. "The Steel Trust is scrapping the whole of its plant," apostrophe he shouted. "The state railways are going to scrap all their engines. Everything's going to be scrapped, everything. Come and scrap the mint, you fellows, come and scrap the mint." ... In the year 1955 the suicide rate for the United States of America quadrupled any previous record. There was an enormous increase also in violent crime throughout the world. The thing had come upon an unprepared humanity. It seemed as though human society was to be smashed by its own magnificent gains. For there had been no foresight of these things. There had been no attempt anywhere, even to compute the probable dislocations this flood of inexpensive energy would produce in human affairs. The world in these days was not really governed at all, in the sense in which government came to be understood in subsequent years. Government was a treaty, not a design. It was forensic, conservative, disputatious, unseeing, unthinking, uncreative. Throughout the world, except where the vestiges of absolutism still sheltered the court favorite and the trusted servant, it was in the hands of the predominant caste of lawyers, who had an enormous advantage in being the only trained caste. their professional education and every circumstance in the manipulation of the fantastically naive electoral methods by which they clambered to power, conspired to keep them contemptuous of facts, conscientiously unimaginative, alert to claim and seize advantages and suspicious of every generosity. Government was an obstructive business of energetic fractions. Progress went on outside of and in spite of public activities, and legislation was the last crippling recognition of needs, so clamorous and imperative, and facts so aggressively established, as to invade even the dingy seclusions of the judges, and threaten the very existence of the otherwise inattentive political machine. The world was so little governed that with the very coming of plenty, in the full tide of an incalculable abundance, when everything necessary to satisfy human needs, and everything necessary to realize such will and purpose as existed then in human hearts was already at hand, one has still to tell of hardship, famine, anger, confusion, conflict, and incoherent suffering. There was no scheme for the distribution of this vast new wealth that had come at last within the reach of men. There was no clear conception that any such distribution was possible. As one attempts a comprehensive view of those opening years of the New Age, as one measures it against the latent achievement that later years have demonstrated, one begins to measure the blindness, the narrowness, the insensate unimaginative individualism of the pre-atomic time. Under this tremendous dawn of power and freedom, under a sky ablaze with promise, in the very presence of science standing like some bountiful goddess over all the squat darknesses of human life, holding patiently in her strong arms, until men chose to take them, security, plenty, the solution of riddles, the key of the bravest adventures, in her very presence, and with the earnest of her gifts in court, the world was to witness such things as the squalid spectacle of the Dastata patent litigation. There in a stuffy court in London, a grimy oblong box of a room, during the exceptional heat of the May of 1956, the leading counsel of the day argued and shouted over a miserable little matter of more royalties or less, and whether the Dastata Company might not bar the Holston Roberts methods of utilizing the new power. The Dastata people were indeed making a strenuous attempt to secure a world monopoly in atomic engineering. The judge, after the manner of those times, sat raised above the court, wearing a preposterous gown and a foolish huge wig. The counsel also wore dirty-looking little wigs, and queer black gowns over their usual costume, wigs and gowns, that were held to be necessary to their pleading, and upon unclean wooden benches stirred and whispered artful-looking solicitors, busily scribbling reporters, the parties to the case, expert witnesses, interested people, and a jostling confusion of subpoenaed persons, briefless young barristers forming a style on the most esteemed, and truculent examples, and casual, eccentric spectators who preferred this pit of iniquity to the free sunlight outside. Everyone was damply hot. The examining king's counsel wiped the perspiration from his huge, clean-shaven upper lip, and into this atmosphere of grasping contention and human exhalations the daylight filtered through a window that was manifestly dirty. The jury sat in a double pew to the left of the judge, looking as uncomfortable as frogs that have fallen into an ash pit, and in the witness box lied the would-be omnivorous Das, under cross-examination. Holston had always been accustomed to publish his results so soon as they appeared to him to be sufficiently advanced to furnish a basis for further work, and to that confiding disposition and one happy flash of adaptive invention the alert Das owed his claim. But indeed a vast multitude of such sharp people were clutching, patenting, preempting, monopolizing this or that feature of the new development, seeking to subdue this gigantic winged power to the purposes of their little lusts and avarice. That trial is just one of innumerable disputes of the same kind. For a time the face of the world festered with patent legislation. It chanced, however, to have one oddly dramatic feature in the fact that Holston, after being kept waiting about the court for 2 days as a beggar might have waited at a rich man's door, after being bullied by ushers and watched by policemen, was called as a witness, rather severely handled by counsel, and told not to quibble by the judge, when he was trying to be absolutely explicit. The judge scratched his nose with a quill pen, and sneered at Holston's astonishment round the corner of his monstrous wig. Holston was a great man, was he? Well, in a law court great men were put in their places. We want to know, has the plaintiff added anything to this or hasn't he? ' said the judge, we don't want to have your views, whether Sir Philip Das's improvements were merely superficial adaptations, or whether they were implicit in your paper. No doubt after the manner of inventors you think most things that were ever likely to be discovered are implicit in your papers. No doubt also you think too that most subsequent additions and modifications are merely superficial. Inventors have a way of thinking that. The law isn't concerned with that sort of thing. The law has nothing to do with the vanity of inventors. The law is concerned with the question whether these patent rights have the novelty the plaintiff claims for them. What that admission may or may not stop, and all these other things you are saying in your overflowing zeal to answer more than the questions addressed to you, none of these things have anything whatever to do with the case in hand. It is a matter of constant astonishment to me in this court to see how you scientific men, with all your extraordinary claims to precision and veracity, wander and wander so soon as you get into the witness box. I know no more unsatisfactory class of witness. The plain and simple question is, has Sir Philip Das made any real addition to existing knowledge and methods in this matter, or has he not? We don't want to know whether they were large or small additions nor what the consequences of your admission may be that you will leave to us. Holston was silent. Surely? Said the judge, almost pityingly. No, he hasn't, said Holston, perceiving that for once in his life he must disregard infinitesimals. Ah! Said the judge, now why couldn't you say that, when counsel put the question? An entry in Holston's diary autobiography, dated 5 days later, runs. Still amazed. The law is the most dangerous thing in this country. It is hundreds of years old. It hasn't an idea. The oldest of old bottles and this new wine, the most explosive wine. Something will overtake them. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.